It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, this is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. And I want to say we're back because we are in New York. We're back in Astoria. We're back on Ditmars Boulevard, where a lot of things started, but not this podcast. Actually, the earlier podcast started. The audio commentaries on audio commentaries. And if you listened to those, you will know our next guest, because our next guest was usually the only sober one in the room.
How unfortunate for me.
For being frightfully underage. But Billy Conahan is here.
Hello. Thank you, John.
And Billy, I met in 2006, and we just figured this out. You were 15?
I believe 2006, I was 14.
You're 14, and yeah. You were doing stand-up comedy
yeah.
in New York, like I was at 33.
you were that old?
I was, yeah. I started...
Not that's old,
I was
30, I'm just
saying. I was 33. I'd started doing videos. I started making videos on high-def cameras and editing them together on the computer, and then didn't know what to do with them, was making DVDs, and then YouTube started. Mm-hmm. And we started doing YouTube, and we got a good reaction, because it was the early days of YouTube, when there was
yeah.
no content.
Well, there was nothing on it.
Yeah, you'd get 50,000 hits, and people would say, that was a good job. Unlike today, where you get 100 hits, and people tell you to die,
right.
and how you should.
Right. Well, yeah, YouTube was more of like, hey, you could check out my reel on this thing, you know, I uploaded my reel to
yes.
this place, you could go see it.
Yes, they were like professionals trying to get things out
exactly.
and trying to use it as a media
mm-hmm.
before it just became the America's Funniest Home Videos of the world.
Of the world.
But we were getting good response from that, and we felt good about it, so we started doing mics. And then that's how I started my stand-up career.
Mm-hmm.
And then all my friends, some of whom have been on the show, we were at an open mic, and so you get up. And everybody still remembers the joke that you wrote at 14 that we all decided we liked you.
What was it?
Which
was it the priest joke?
No, it was the vampire joke.
What's the vampire joke?
You don't remember your own jokes?
No.
If vampires can't see themselves in the mirror, why do they have nice hair?
Nice hair. Yeah. I was later told that is a hack joke.
I still think it's a good joke.
It's a great joke.
It's not
but
connected
I was later,
to anything.
I was later told it was a hack joke.
By someone bitter and angry?
Yes.
Basically, everything's a hack joke that I'm not doing.
Right, right. No, no, no.
Or it's a hack joke because you had done it 7 times.
Right, probably.
Yeah.
Or I was 14.
I don't think I've ever asked you this, but now you're how old now?
23.
Okay, so we've known each other...
For maybe 9 years.
Yeah, maybe 9 years. I never asked you, because I think at that point, I don't think I'd be able to get an answer from a 14-year-old. What made you decide to start doing stand-up comedy seriously in clubs at 14? Were you doing stuff in school and then this was the next level, or was it a pure jump off the cliff?
It was kind of just I can't even explain. I remember exactly having this memory of, I passed this pub, you know, not McCann's. What is it? It's right up here. O'Hanlon's. O'Hanlon's,
okay.
Right here on Ditmars. And in the window was open mic. Open mics on Tuesdays or whatever. And I just distinctly remember looking at it, going in and asking if I could do it. And they said yes. And so I went home and I wrote jokes to, like, I have no real idea why I started doing it, honestly. I liked making people laugh, and I thought it was, a public forum kind of thing. People,
uh-huh.
I could say whatever I wanted. There was a lot of freedom in that, especially at 14.
Yeah, I had much more built up in my head where I grew up watching HBO specials and watching
mm-hmm.
George Carlin and Robin Williams and Billy Crystal and thinking, I can't believe somebody can do that. And then when I finally got over my fear of it, I was like, oh, I can do that?
Yeah.
So for me, it was kind of climbing a mountain to get there. But as you're saying, somebody said, Do you want to start telling? And did you say comedy, or were there musicians on the open mics? Because a lot of these open mics.
Yeah, yeah, no. It was a music open mic.
So what made you decide that you weren't going to play music? Because you play music now.
Right. Well, I wasn't a musician then at all. I couldn't play a thing. So I started.
So you said I can't play any instruments. Therefore, I will pick an entirely different genre.
Right. Well, music wasn't on my mind at the point. It was. I felt like I had some stuff to say. Mm-hmm. That was bizarre and strange, and I don't know. I needed a public place to do it that wasn't in front of kids.
Right.
Like, you know, actually talking to adults. So that was definitely something I wanted to do. I wanted to kind of have an adult conversation.
Yeah, that happened quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been bitter and angry ever since.
Your life ended by 17.
Yeah. I was already recovering alcoholic at 18.
You're doing mics in the neighborhood. A lot of people, that would be it. Like,
right.
You kind of become a fixture in your neighborhood. I know there was a space here called the Waltz Astoria that we all used to go to when we lived here, and you were a big part of. So what made you decide, I'm going to go on the train and go to a comedy club where it really happens and just get up? Because that's the kind of thing that I thought about when I was your age, when I was watching specials, and I was living in Rockaway, which is farther than Astoria from Manhattan, but not too much farther. Never went in.
Like, yeah.
You know, even doing speech and debate in school and competition, never did that until I was in my 30s.
I think it was just kind of, I would like go into the city to, you know, meet my dad or something, and you would pass these comedy clubs, like Hot Comedy Club, and just looking at it and being like, that's where I want to be. I want to be on a stage being, you know, ladies and gentlemen, that, you know, I want that whole big
spiel. Never banned at any show.
Yay. And there was, yeah, there's still, I play music now and there's not a band to bring me up. But there was, I don't know, honestly, it's like, I never saw myself doing anything else, and I wanted to do it. I always do my own interviews in my head, you know, like, oh, I'm going to be on the Tonight Show. Someone's going to, you know, I'm going to be witty and funny.
That.
Yeah, we
all,
and that happened real young, like, and so I was like, yeah, if I could become tighter, funnier, you know, I want to be around the people that I want to work with and be regarded as a peer rather than just a kid. I was very much about, I guess it's more kind of a respect thing. Like,
that's interesting, because I felt the same way a lot of time, where it was more important for me to make comedians laugh than to make audiences laugh.
Oh, yeah.
And then as I kept doing it, I just kept hosting, and I was fine with that.
Right.
And, you know, and nobody wanted to host because everybody wanted to do their 10 minutes and really shine. And I was just fine moving the scenery along and keeping the show from dropping. Because I liked being around these people. And I liked being thought of as funny by people that I thought were funny.
Yeah.
So you kind of had, you would say you would have the same kind of.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you get laughs from comedians, that's like, that'll change everything. You know what I mean? It's one thing to get, you know, a bar to laugh, but to get the guy standing in the wings, the guy who's next, to be like, that was a good, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, those guys have heard everything.
Yeah, and those guys have heard and seen everything, and it's like, I wanted to be one of those guys. Definitely wanted to be the dude in the wing, looking at the dude, arms crossed, laughing, you know what I mean? Like, that was definitely a challenge, I think, that I wanted to really go at.
Yeah, and it happened pretty quickly, because it was, there was always this feeling when you got up, as I said, you were like 14, 15, you were like pre-puberty before you got
definitely
up. And you were called Billy the Kid for a long
time. Still get that.
Yeah, I'm trying not to say
that. No, it's fine. I mean, it's more endearing now.
In Howard Beach, I was Kid Clark until I had children.
Clark.
I got that when I was like 16.
People are just finding ways to jab.
Alliteration. You can't beat alliteration.
You can't do it, man.
At least Billy the Kid, if your name was Killy the Kid.
Now there's Killy Dwyer.
Yeah, well, but it's not
still,
you.
That's my
entire point. You'll never be Killy Dwyer, no matter how hard you try.
No, can't do it.
Yeah,
just can't do what she does.
There was this feeling when we saw you of like, oh, this is going to be cute, and then it's going to be embarrassing.
Yeah.
And there were other kids getting up and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my first mic, there was a kid was clearly a high school student who started telling us the middle of a story that made his friends laugh a month ago with no context.
Right.
And then it just went into this, like, he immediately, like, one-upped himself to the point where it made no sense and then got upset with us.
When you didn't laugh.
Yeah, and that was my first mic. And I was like, because he hadn't written anything. And that's what you kind of expected. When you got up, you had jokes. I mean, there was a, I remember Mitch Hedberg was a huge influence.
Oh, yeah.
Those were all definitely about tight, concise.
One-liners, non-sequiturs. Yeah. And I thought that was great. I thought I had a pretty keen eye for the observational kind of stuff with my own twist on it, I guess. And
as opposed to the life experiences.
Right. Yeah, because I didn't, you know, I mean, that was kind of the funny part. It was like I didn't really have a life experience at that point. So I didn't want to talk about myself. I kind of wanted to go up there and be funny, you know, and get that laugh about anything, you know, a traffic light or I wanted that everyday kind of stuff that we all experience, and
right,
that New York kind of living.
Now, how long were you in it? You were, it was like, I want to say it was like 4 years?
Stand-up?
Yeah, stand-up.
About four hard years, yeah.
Zero easy years.
Zero easy years.
Four hard ones.
Yeah.
Why would you say it's hard?
Well, the open mic scene for comedy is a lot different than music.
Well, now being a musician, walk me through each one.
All right, well, a comedy open mic, usually you could do like four in a night because they started at 3 p.m. And you could go to like Parkside Lounge.
A lot of them were comedy clubs that opened at 7 and, that figured if they could get really bad comedians to pay $3 to be in there at 4, then one person needed to open the door.
So pretty much that was it. It was like somewhere to go after school. You know, at first it started like that. So, but just the trying jokes in front of comedians who are just trying to get up there and tell new jokes the same as you. Nobody wants to have a good time. So
there was an active feeling of let's not have a good
let's
time.
Not enjoy any of who's going on stage whatsoever. You don't understand. I need to do these jokes and leave immediately. I think that was what the feeling was.
Yeah, there are several people now that are very famous that used to come in, do their jokes, and leave immediately.
Yeah, so,
and we were kind of the people that hung out.
Yeah, very much so. And what? No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was trying to kind of build a community as much as I wanted to. So the people that I thought were funny, I wanted to talk to afterwards.
I wanted to go hang out. Yeah. Like, I mean, being 15, you can't like go get a drink after, you know. You can't like stand outside and share a smoke. Like there wasn't any of that.
Yeah, you can stand outside.
Yeah, I just stood outside, but I was totally okay with like following groups of people, you know, mic to mic, and so the difference now is music is like, I don't know, it's really transferable. Like you could go from a pub to a nightclub to the back alley of a joint and do the same set, and people will love it, or you know, depending. But comedy is like, all right, I have to adjust. I can't do this joke because they're not going to get it in one room. Or, you know what I mean? It's
Especially when you would do the 3 in a night, it would be the same people at all 3 of them.
Right, exactly, because you're walking around with them.
Yeah, yeah. Unless you were one of the people that ran there to get up early.
Yeah, so sign up.
It was such a thrill to be in the first 10.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you were in the first 10, you probably had the best open mic set.
Yeah, if you got in, I remember the Parkside Lounge, I'd always be around 20, and I would have to go around and remind everybody that I was going in. Because even the people that liked me, like I wasn't trying
like,
to make
hey,
people
man,
suffer
I gotta
through
go.
It. But I was like, I don't want to be up there in front of an empty room. It's like, please stop watching the game and hear this one bit.
Yeah. Comedy, there's a lot of competition just... Like, when you're on stage, there's competition. You have to, like, fight for people's attention. Because if you're, you know, talking can become monotonous for some people. But music, you know, there's something going on. They can watch your hand, whatever. There's a whole bunch of different things going on.
You
but comedy
need,
is very... I need to grasp
need
their attention.
Undivided attention.
Yes, I need... So
makes,
you could hear the setup, the punchline, the tag. into the callback later. You know what I mean? Like,
and that's what makes it so fragile. There's so many rooms where it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it can't be too big a room, you know, because the,
gets
the
lost
sound has
in
to
translate.
Hit the back and come back. It can't be too quiet of a room because it's too serious and people don't want to make any noise, including laughing.
You know? The last thing they want to do is laugh.
Right.
And
they
feel like being
feeling because everyone's feeling very self-conscious in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the coffee houses are like that because people aren't relaxed. People are caffeinated.
Yes.
So they're thinking like, well, I don't want to be the center of attention. No, go ahead and do your joke.
Yeah.
And I will nod.
I will nod and agree.
I used to get a lot of smilers. I used to get so many smilers where I was like, where I thought in the room it did great because I was looking at people's faces. And I was like, people are really enjoying this. And then I would listen to just the audio of it.
And there's not a laugh.
And they, no.
And you're like, but that joke killed.
And then there'd be 5 seconds, and then there would be me going, yeah, and,
And, on to the next
every
one.
Every transition I had was yeah, and, Every single transition for every
And those
bit.
Tapes can be miserable.
Oh, I... They were
listening back... oh, yeah.
I'd have, like, 10,
there was a certain
I
point where I stopped.
I couldn't
record my set anymore, because I just couldn't bear to listen to...
Me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just the dead, awkward... You could hear how awkward it was.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really... It hurts your self-esteem. I don't know. It's...
And just not just the mics. The mics could be... If you had a lot of friends in the room, the mics could be fun.
Right.
Like, they could be raucous. Sometimes Parkside Lounge is great. The New York Comedy Club mic was just a train wreck. But sometimes it had this bawdy atmosphere... Like, basically, if the same crew got up 3-4 guys in a row, it was really fun.
Right.
And
because people would just tag on to whatever they were doing.
And people would listen to each other. And you start to do crowd work
with the
people
comics.
In the room. Yeah. It was terrible if you weren't part of that crew.
Yeah, because then you're trying jokes and people are in the back going, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah, there is that. That's a big thing in comedy. You really have to
overcome.
It's
very clickish. Comedy is very clickish.
Because of the competition, I think.
I mean,
because that's nobody, you know, it's like when,
not to say that music isn't,
when
music
you watch but when you watch Survivor, and they're always building these alliances, and I'm thinking, why are you building alliances when this is a zero-sum game? But then I realized because you can't go it alone, and comedy's kind of like that.
You can't do it alone.
No,
much as it is you on stage doing your act and your jokes and stuff, you need those people to be like, hey, I just got big. You want to open?
Right.
Like,
and you know, we have, I mean, the crews that we ran with, maybe, I want to say like maybe 8-9 core people. There are 2 super famous guys now in that clique.
Well,
1 or 2 super famous guys, 1 or 2 guys that are doing really well.
Yeah. I mean, it depends
and
on.
And then a few guys that aren't doing it and a few guys that are doing the same thing. You have that ranking within each crew. You never have a whole crew do well.
Right.
Even, you know, Rob Schneider wasn't as popular as Adam Sandler.
Right. But he brought him with him.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's the beautiful part of that.
Right.
I definitely was on my way out when New Orleans showed up. Like, Neil Stasny and Mark and...
Yeah, Mark Normans, who's been on the show. Those guys were really good. Basically, the best guys in New Orleans came up to New York after
Zach
Hurricane
Sims.
Katrina.
Yeah, exactly.
Sean Patton.
Sean Patton.
Sean Patton was the elephant in the room. Like.
JFOD.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a big list of people that showed up in New York at the same time, like 2008, and flooded the market. And they were so good that they made me feel bad about my act. I was like, nah, I'm not doing the act I want to do anymore. I was no longer doing, you know what I mean? There was a point where now I want to start doing material about this and that, or myself, or I don't know. These guys were just so natural.
They forced you to
improve.
To move up, yeah.
But I wasn't, you know, pretty intimidated at that point. And my mind just wasn't in it. Like, you know, I mean, I feel like 4 or 5 years of hard mics, like, really eating that scene up. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden these guys come in and they're just sweeping.
Well, I remember the
game.
I
was like, whoo.
For me, the game really changed when The Creek opened.
Oh, great. When they did like 51st Jokes, when they did the Halloween stuff.
Kingdom of Heaven.
Kingdom of Heaven with Sean Patton and JFLD.
Yeah, and there was, Jimmy Williams had the
I was going to say, Timmy Williams, Whitest Kids You Know,
Whitest
was in there.
Whitest Kids You Know had a sketch show at that point.
John Mulaney was still hanging around. Matt McCarthy was hanging around.
Yep.
I mean, big names in comedy now. Pete Holmes. Those guys were in the back.
Yeah, Hannibal Buress, Eric Andre. I mean,
Andre, dude. One of the best sets I had ever seen at Writer's Room.
Yes, which was the show that Mike Drucker, who's been on the show, who's now a writer for Fallon, did. Eric Andre just made the room explode.
That was the first time I saw him do the Wendy's
the Baconator.
Baconator bit, and he did it for 8 minutes.
Yes.
And that's when I really was like, I am not a comic in that sense. Huh. Like, those guys really had a developed sense of their style and their whole, you know what I mean?
And they oozed it
because they were so naturally those guys. And, you know, at the end of the show, they're still those people. They're smart asses. And, that does come
with time because
those
guys had been at it longer. I mean, like you're saying about the New Orleans scene, those guys were doing it in New Orleans and built themselves up before they got to New York. And when they got to New York, they were at the back of the line where we were because we were starting.
Right.
And you and I are two of the very few people I knew in comedy that were born in New York.
Right.
So they had built themselves up to the point where they felt they could move to New York, where you and I just left our goddamn house that day.
Right, exactly.
Like, you know what? Am I going to watch a DVD tonight or am I going to do 5 minutes? I'll do five minutes.
I remember some of those nights. We would be at your house all day jamming.
Yep.
Six, 7 o'clock rolls around, and then we were like, are we going to go 2 hours into the city to do 3.5 minutes for nobody? Why not? Let's do it. We made a whole night of it.
And we were right on the train.
Right on the train, tell the jokes, then complain about it on the way back.
Yes. I had this palm-sized spiral notebook that could fit in a jacket pocket.
And I remember your leather jacket.
Yes, still have that leather jacket. The notebook I found, every single page was full.
Yeah.
From 4 years, which is how long I really did. Every was full of jokes and premises and just like some things made no sense. Like there's one page that just says flat stomach. I believe I turned it into a joke eventually, but it was in there for 6 months.
Oh, gee. And yeah, they just cook and fester.
Yeah,
in there.
Some things are hilarious when you think of them and then you start to say it out loud and it just crumbles in the air between
you, can
hear
you
and the other person.
You ever get halfway through a joke and you're like, this is not going to end well. And I think the audience feels it because you just deliver the joke and they're just, no, we're not going to laugh at that. And you're like, I just want to apologize half the time. I think another big thing was in all the years I did stand up, I never found my voice. I never had my style down.
You did it at such a point in your life where you don't have a voice.
Yeah,
that was
very
a
much
big
so.
Thing. I found with me was I had two things. I was kind of at the forefront of geek humor. There were not a lot of people doing it. Patton Oswalt was the only guy I knew that was doing like nerdy stuff.
Werewolves and Lollipops.
In 2006.
Brian Posehn, the Comedians of Comedy, like right around, right
Comedians
before Zach Galifianakis, Maria Bamford.
And then it just became
the thing, like alt,
well,
alt comedy.
Well, once the started.
Alt comedy came
alt
into
comedy
its own
became
thing.
Nerd comedy. You know, once Kumail moved from here over to LA and hooked up with Joan and started doing Meltdown. And then I had that, and then my son was born. The second year I was doing stand-up.
Yeah.
And I just had all of this baby material, which, you know, Ray Romano and Louis C.K. had well covered.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm kind of, after a couple of years, I'm like, I'm kind of doing these guys, and I'm kind of doing these guys. And I'm putting them together, and I haven't quite found my thing. And as you were saying, when the New Orleans guys came up, I was happy to be in the room.
It was great to watch them work.
And they were great. They were supportive. They weren't, you know, competitive. They weren't derisive. But it was like, but just to know, hey, I'm in the room with this guy that's this good. Oh, and as we were saying before, making comedians laugh. I just made that guy laugh who's incredibly funny.
Right.
I was like, that means something. And then, as I said, once the Creek opened, it went to another level. And now the Creek is kind of like Gotham. In the
a little
old
bit.
Scene. It's so big. I mean, Ted Alexander did his hour special at the Creek.
Yeah, I was there.
Were you?
Yeah, he actually did a whole week. And he just took, like, whatever best stuff
best parts,
from...
Yeah.
But he took a lot of it from, like, the Saturday night thing.
Right.
But,
Yeah, Ted was on the show when the video came out.
Awesome. What, I did it?
Yeah, I did it. Which
That's
fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah, and which is still...
That was on Letterman. I mean, he was...
Yeah, Ted, and Ted's a fantastic guy.
Oh, sweet, you know. Sweet guy.
But wow. When the creek opened, that was the feeling. It wasn't, again, it wasn't, I didn't feel as competitive like you're losing ground or these guys are gaining on you or passing you. It was just, it was a much bigger game. It felt like we had moved from our small town, even though,
right.
I said, we lived here.
Right.
We lived here and we went to the New York Comedy Club and we went to the Improv.
Yeah.
And, you know, I handed out flyers
Broadway
at
Comedy
the Improv.
Club, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, which became the Broadway Comedy Club. And, you know, you did these little clubs that were still kind of stuck in the 80s and were slowing down, like the gears were getting rusty.
Definitely felt that.
Yeah,
you
but it was like that was the
struggling to get an audience into the place. And
we
like
stand out on Times Square. And you didn't want to do it. You weren't old enough and you were a little too smart to hand out flyers. But you used to come with me.
Oh, yeah, I would stand there. I would stand there with you guys. Why not? Because we get to, you know, we get to bullshit. And
hung out, and then we'd hand out flyers. I have video somewhere of us handing out flyers.
Do you really?
I've never
I would love to see
it. I was going to make a YouTube video of barkers, which is what we called ourselves. You know, they said, the guys that ran the clubs hated the word barkers because it's demeaning, because it is. But what we were doing was demeaning, so we embraced
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you gotta live
like
your... you gotta live... Your low life self a little
yeah,
bit. You really got to not loathe it, but you got to enjoy it while you're there.
I finally stopped doing it. I was going on vacation, and then when I came back from vacation, I just never contacted the club ever again. And then we started our own thing at Rafifi's, and then later at the
which, by the way, is now a Buffalo Exchange.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rafifi's
that's the hilarious part about
Rafifi's
it.
Rafifi's closed while we were doing it.
While we were doing it.
We moved over to... No, not Upright Citizens Brigade. We moved to the Pit, People's Improv Theater.
So what happened? I think another thing that really so I started getting older, and I felt like I wasn't growing. I guess I also started smoking pot.
Well, you're like
and,
5'4".
Yeah. I started smoking pot and hanging out with, you know, I just was trying to get laid half the time, probably.
You weren't going
to
get laid in a comedy club.
No. And no matter how funny you are at 16, no one wants to give you the light of
there
day.
There are
no
16-year-olds in the
comedy
club.
Exactly.
You know who there are in the comedy club? Jaded waitresses. And
hey,
comics?
The jaded waitresses loved me.
Let's oh, hey, yeah, they were great. The jaded waitresses and the female comics... Who were suspicious.
Yes, very much so. Didn't
and
trust anybody.
Some of them
Why
were
would they? Why would they?
Obviously, they've been hit on hundreds of times before they got into a room with you.
Yeah. So when I didn't hit on them, I guess that was the attractive part.
It was the safety.
It was the safety.
To.
Yeah. Looking back at it now.
No fear of attack.
Yeah, no, that's pretty accurate. No wonder I had it so good.
I remember handing out flyers for the Improv when it was still the Improv, and it would be pouring rain, and you would get back right before your set, and you're trying to dry off on stage.
Oh, I remember watching people dry.
Yeah.
Like, you know where the like,
audience could
where the coat ends?
Yeah, or the umbrella.
And the wherever, yeah. And you could just see, like, the fault line of, like, the rain. And not only that... Half the audience only came in to get out of the rain.
And could not speak English.
Could not speak English. Didn't know what was happening.
Oh. My standard joke through the winter of 06 was there would be 7 people in the audience. And every comic would make fun of them for being 7 people. And I would get up and go, don't let anybody bother you about being 7 people. There were 7 people on Gilligan's Island. That show's been on for 50 years. But I was able to use that joke 3 nights a week. Because there weren't more than 10.
Yeah,
and there were always a few that didn't speak English. You would do crowd work with them. You'd be like, hey, are you from here? And they go, we want chicken wings.
All you got was country of origin and having a good time? All right.
And they would toast you. They would always say,
yeah,
hey,
thanks. You realize that I'm not going to get anything. I think, you know what doesn't help your self-esteem? When you can do a joke for seven people. Like, that becomes, like, your staple. Like, yeah. You know what? This joke only works three times out of the... because I worked for seven... I could really kill an audience that has seven people
in
it.
I remember I was talking to... I think it was Mike Drucker, and he was telling me he was reading this interview about Seth Rogen. And Seth Rogen was complaining about doing stand-up. And he said in the interview, one night I did a show for four people. And I was like, did he do it for 6 months?
Yeah. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. I don't think... Well, he's been a kid actor for a while. You think he had to bark?
He
didn't have to bark.
I don't know. I mean, we were told everybody needed to bark, but that's when we were barking.
Right.
I mean, there was this... That was a funny thing when we were doing... There was this system in place, which no longer worked.
No.
But we were told that was a system if you wanted to succeed. So we all entered that system. And then in the middle of that, the alt comedy scene really started to happen. And before that, it had been happening with improv. And then... While we were there in 06, all of a sudden, improv and stand-up in New York started to fuse
right.
and become one scene. And that doesn't always happen. In Chicago, stand-up and improv are still fairly segregated. You know, you have Zanies.
Well, you got, like,
you
Second City. I mean,
Second City.
It's a very... There's a divide there because it's kind of...
People aren't running across the street.
Right. No, but in New York, it was the same rooms.
Yeah.
Like Cake Shop. And, you know, like... Under St. Mark's Beauty Bar.
Right.
I mean, like, you got a lot of these, like, literally coming out from the 8 o'clock show is completely different from the 10 o'clock show.
Yep.
But there's still people mingling. There's, you know, I mean, I feel like some people stick around mm-hmm. for whole nights.
Yeah, and I think it just took a while because there used to be no improv in New York until Upright Citizens Brigade opened.
Mm.
And that opened in New York because the four of them got a Comedy Central deal, so they came to New York to do the show, which is, you know, Amy Poehler, Matt Besser, Ian Walsh, you know, Matt Walsh and Ian Roberts. And they opened, they basically took all the money they got from Comedy Central, opened the theater.
I mean...
And the show ran for like three seasons or something, and then Amy got picked up for Saturday Night Live pretty quickly. But then that became the hub of improv, and I went there... That's 6 years, about around 2000, I took writing classes and improv classes there, and I realized I was horrible at improv because I didn't want to go without the security net.
Right.
I wanted to control what was going to happen on the stage.
Yeah.
I wanted to know the beginning, middle, and end before I opened my mouth.
Well, that's what's happening now is that comedians are coming from more of a, I feel like more of an improv kind of background now.
Mm-hmm.
More, you know, they're more... used to being on the fly.
Well, because there's been such a mix.
Oh, yeah.
One of the best definitely. Sets I ever did was hosting an improv show.
I believe that.
And I hosted three, and I wrote jokes on stage that I used for 6 months. Because they, like, just worked, and then when I did it again, it worked.
Yeah.
But there was this interest in fusion, and then when Mike and I started our show at Rafifi's, which you hosted every time we couldn't get a host...
Oh, yeah.
We just threw you up there.
Yeah, I remember.
But we would have improv. We would have video. We would have digital sketches. And we'd have improv groups. Murderfist was amazing. They're still out there.
Yeah.
Murderfist would come on.
They're hysterical.
They would get naked on stage.
Yeah, they're hysterical.
Yeah, they're incredible. I can't believe they don't have a show.
I'm sure it's in the works somewhere.
I'm sure it's been optioned. But there was this nice... mix, and there was this feeling at the time of that it was all one scene, you know,
mm-hmm.
and everybody was, like I said, everybody was kind of in the room. So when you had a headliner, like we would have Pete Holmes on the show, he'd just come and hang out. People would hang out.
He was there all night.
Yeah. Yeah. People, it was the opposite of what would happen at the open mics. People wouldn't do their sets and run away.
Right.
People would
stick around.
Yeah.
I mean, you fill the set with, like, you know, you got the five acts and then the headliner. And the five acts are fantastic,
mm-hmm.
and they all want to watch each other. But right. everyone's there to see the headliner, and the headliner shows up like halfway through the show. But you get to kind of mingle with
them.
Sometimes
at the beginning, I remember like Ted would come at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, you get to mingle and talk to these guys, and you're all peers. Like
right.
you know, I mean, no matter where or you're in the same room right now. So I think that was a big thing.
Yeah, I got to a point after I moved where I would see a guy I knew on TV once a week.
Oh, yeah, that happens more now.
Yeah, now it's like
than
every 3 days. And
a
you
commercial
don't even have a TV.
To, yeah. Well, every time I look up at a commercial, it's like Matt McCarthy or something.
Yeah.
So I was watching Daredevil. Who was Tom?
Tom McCaffrey.
Tom McCaffrey
was
on Daredevil, yep. And I was like, oh.
Well, it's at the point now where I just name names while I'm watching TV.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, and like sometimes Renee had seen them, and sometimes doesn't.
Yeah.
And I'm like, look, there he is. It's almost like flipping through a picture book.
It's very. I've gotten used to it. I love it.
Yeah.
Because it reminds me of like, I'm that close. Like that 6 degrees of separation is literally.
It's 1 degree. Now.
It's 1 degree.
Right.
And so. That's what's fascinating about the growth. Comedy definitely helped with music, though, in terms of my finding my voice and finding my comfort zone on stage. Because now,
like finding your legs on stage, or writing wise,
A little of both.
Okay,
because I still have my sense of humor. I feel it's still you know, prevalent, so I use it. But I could banter. I could talk on stage like not a lot of musicians can.
Right.
I could really kill time. I can make an audience laugh. You know what I mean? I could really bring them to the highs and lows because of comedy.
That's the most important thing, I think. Stand-up for me is you learn how to read a room in a way you don't.
Oh.
Because I come from the opposite track of you. I was in bands from like the end of high school, very, very seriously in college, and then into my 20s. And I was in a band about 6 months before I started doing stand-up, and it was going nowhere. It was in Astoria. It was like hitting the wall, and I was like, I'm out. You know what? And at that point, I was 30. I'm like, I'm done with this. I'm not doing this anymore. Like, this is crazy. I'm wasting my time. And then 2 months later, I was on a stage doing stand-up. So obviously, there's something that I need to get out, which is kind of why I'm doing this now, because, you know, I got a job and 2 kids and a band, you know, all at once. And I need to do this, but I found that when I went back to being in a band, I could read an audience much better.
Oh, it's night and day.
You can change the set list on the fly and go, you know what? They're not going to sit through a slow song.
That's what I love.
Rocking, you know? Yeah. Or you know what? Now's time to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now is not the time to talk to them.
I mean, you could pick that so fast, and you know, you think about it, and it may seem like a long thought, but it'll happen in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
You'll be like, all right, we're going to switch the set. 1, 2, 3, go. Bam, bam. You know what I mean? Like,
you'll be thinking about it during the last verse sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be like,
oh, yeah.
You'll be like, oh, this, I know what we need to follow this with.
Right.
And you're right. There are so many bands where I hosted a music festival this weekend.
Yeah.
It was really fun until
in Rockaway.
Yeah, until it got rained out.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I couldn't make that. It was pouring all weekend.
We'd held out till about 4, so we got through most of the bands. The last 3 bands, unfortunately, got washed out. But it was basically just my job to introduce the bands and like plug t-shirts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it was just fun. And I was going there going, I haven't written anything. I don't have anything. And then I was like, then all of a sudden as the band's ending, I'm like, I got 3 jokes about the wind.
Yeah. Exactly.
I would do them, but then there was, some bands were a little out of it, let's say.
Yeah.
And forgot that I was hosting and just started talking. And they were the kind of bands that stared at the floor and talked about what the song meant to them before they played the song.
Musicians also, pretty on occasion, are terrible talkers.
Yeah.
Which I think is ironic, considering like they can have beautiful voices and play amazing.
And write lyrics.
But then when it comes to like introducing the song, it'll take 5 minutes, and I just I cannot stand that, man.
I
need to get going, bro.
Well, you can very easily get lost in the band when you're on stage playing music, and you can think, you can pay attention to the other guys you're on stage with, and that's about it. And like, you're hoping to hear applause at the end of the song, and other than that, you don't really need the audience. And stand up, like we said, it's so fragile. You need them every step of the way.
Well, I look at music like that. It's like, yeah, I could do this and I can record and I could put it out and people will download it or whatever, but the magic really comes from when they see you live and you make eye contact with them, and you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of power in the audience, and that's what I learned from stand-up, is that the audience will really, you know, pick you up when you're down.
Yeah, as long
as they'll shut you down.
Yeah, as long as you're listening to them. It's like, it gives you the perfect ears for an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that amazed me about stand-up was that how
symbiotic
rooms rooms generate a personality.
It's amazing.
It's so weird.
The mob mentality kind of idea.
And you don't know who. There's no leader.
No.
There's no one in charge, but it just goes this way.
But it'll take one person to go boo to get everyone.
Oh, my God.
You know
yes.
what I mean?
Yeah.
It can be
the same room. You can have the 8 o'clock show and it's great, and then the 10 o'clock show is death.
Yeah.
And then the midnight show is fantastic.
It's amazing. Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons I stopped was it was just like, there was nothing I could count on to keep my self-esteem
long enough.
Going.
Yeah, no. That self-esteem takes a major dive.
Major beating.
Major dive. And especially, and then when you start, it starts happening on stage where you can't just bring your, you can't get it up anymore. You know what I mean? You just can't, well, hey, everybody, you can't do that
the
anymore.
The job is, and the first part of the job is not doing that voice.
Well, this is where I fall out. It's just...
Strangely enough, you're not doing drive time. Welcome back. It's Johnny and the Kid coming at you.
What
do you think about that Obama kid?
What, diners, drive-ins, and diners, drive-ins, and dives. Right? That's the show.
Yeah, we pulled into this drive-thru outside Wichita.
Really?
And we heard it was the greasiest burger imaginable.
Let's go in and find out. No, yeah. I guess that's rule one. Don't do that.
No. No, I think that was the end of the podcast 2 minutes ago because we started doing that. The nice thing about podcasts is you can't hear people push the stop button, but you can see them unsubscribe.
I hope you keep a nice register of when exactly part of the podcast they stop listening.
Yeah, I feel like when this comes out, right at that moment, I'll just get a chill.
Yeah. Trust
Somebody
me.
Listen
so,
to the part again.
So will they. So will they. Oh, I'm sorry I've lost you several subscribers, man. I apologize about that. This has been... Sorry.
So when you got into music, I remember you started out doing folk and then hip-hop came in. So where are you now? Is it a mixture of the two? Do you go back and forth or...
I'm a strictly hip-hop artist. In
there are
terms
two acoustic
of,
guitars next to you.
Right.
God
damn
it.
I'm getting there, John. Well, I write... In terms of, I'm writing rap constantly. Beat, you know, and... That's what I do. That's like putting out an album. Check out the album in a few months. And that's what I make kind of my place right now. Like, I am a rapper. I get booked as a rapper, and I do that. I play acoustic. Like, I may have a song I write randomly, and I'll just play it at home. It's like therapeutic, you know, to play the guitar. Or go to the mic that's like two blocks away and just do... You know, they all know me as a rapper, so when I show up with a guitar, they're like, oh, I didn't know you played. You know what I mean? Like, I like that kind of new feeling. But,
right, yeah.
But, no, the singer-songwriter thing wasn't really kind of something I was like, all right, this is what I'm going to do. It was kind of more like therapy, you know, getting it done, writing.
Well, it seemed like it was kind of dipping your toe in the water. because a little bit. It was that transition between writing jokes and writing rhymes.
Yeah.
It's kind of... Now, would you say joke writing has informed the way you write lyrics?
Oh, completely. Yeah, yeah. I look at lyrics as like the setup, the punchline, and occasionally a tag. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very formulaic in that sense of like, it. You know, not necessarily I'm looking for a laugh, but looking for, you know, recognition on a subject and then getting the nod of like, oh, I understand that. I get that, you know. And so I'm adjusting. I'm not saying I write for an audience all the time, but I'm always adjusting, like, this is what people are going to want to hear, and this is what people are going to tune out. And
again, getting that feedback.
Yeah.
Which is so instantaneous in stand-up, whereas in music, it's very easy to just go, yeah, people like that song, and not change it.
Right.
Like, I was shocked. Songs that I wrote in my 20s, like, I'll hear it back, and I'll just hear this lyric where I was like, why didn't I rewrite that? I was like, because it didn't bomb. That's
right.
Why.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, you know what? I need to get to a rhyme which says this word, and I need it to kind of be about this to carry the theme along, and it's just clunky.
Yeah, you know, it's you're just trying so hard to get there.
Yeah, you're shoving the words in with a crowbar,
and they don't. Yeah, it doesn't fit the right meter sometimes.
It's like,
and
it might have taken 3 hours to fix that, and
I just never got around to it.
Yeah, because you know what? It didn't scare me enough. I didn't get to the point where it's like, if I say this, it's gonna bomb, and I'm gonna feel bad.
Right.
And joke writing is constantly.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We had that whole obsession with the economy of words and jokes. Remember that?
Going
around just removing every single word
that was not
necessary.
Oh yeah, well we were totally big on how long a pause was. I mean, there's definitely a science behind what makes and how to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Like the pause, the punchline, where the tag needs to be.
Right.
That stuff again is formulaic. You gotta have a pretty good idea of how to tell a joke.
Yeah.
Because you could give the same joke to two different people. One guy who doesn't know how to tell it and one who does. And you'll be amazed by how different it'll sound coming out of someone.
Did you ever see that Comedy Central roast where they let the situation do a set?
It was possibly the worst thing I'd ever seen.
It was, and you could see that, like, Jeffrey Ross wrote his jokes and he ran over the punchlines. He did one into another and it was like he had no idea.
He couldn't tell a joke.
Yeah, not to disparage him as a human being, which is easy to do, but but that was somebody who had no clue how to tell a joke. And usually, when you give a joke to someone who is not a comedian, they're at least an actor or a broadcaster,
so they know how to read a line.
They know a rhythm,
right?
They know when to go up and when to come down.
That's what I'm talking about.
You know, William Shatner
dynamics.
William Shatner has never been a comedian.
No,
but you could give him a joke and he could at least land it.
Yeah. Well, especially if you give him, like, a character.
Right.
And you're like, all right, just base it off of, you know, if you write for Shatner, Shatner will write. It will be William Shatner.
So will Adam West.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, they know their roles now.
It is a learned skill. And it's...
Do you watch Comedians in Cars? Getting Coffee?
Yeah, I love it, actually.
I love those interviews.
Yes.
And I just watched one with Steve Harvey. And
that's great. That's in Chicago.
Yeah. Oh, dude, they're driving that really 57 Chevrolet thing. I love that. But he's just making points of like what he says when he walks into when his friends ask him to show up at a comedy class. Can you give some words of advice?
Yeah.
And he just goes, "If you are here, you will never make it." Which is totally
It's true.
You can't teach it. No. Whatever it is, that natural persona kind of stuff, you can't teach that stuff.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, they say comedy is timing and it's rhythm. And we're two people who have both been musicians and comedians.
Mm.
And I see it with my two sons. I don't know, you know, obviously I can't predict the future where they're going to be. But they both have a very natural sense of rhythm. Like, I have a drum set in my house. They both sat behind the drum set. And obviously they're not, you know, doing syncopated beats. But just when they hit the drums.
One, two, three, four.
Yeah,
one,
very
two,
natural.
Three, four.
Both of them. You know, the 2-year-old and the 8-year-old. And I'm watching as they develop. And Sebastian, any song that comes on, a theme song, a commercial, immediately starts dancing, smiling, trying to learn the lyrics and singing. Ben, not that interested. But the comedy of it is getting funnier and funnier and funnier. When he listens to music, he wants to listen to the Muppets and Weird Al and Flight of the Conchords and Simpsons soundtracks.
Lovely.
You know? And it's that's, but they both have that sense of rhythm.
Natural
rhythm. I think is genetic.
I mean, when you grow up in it, I mean, it becomes genetic. I think
it's even more. I think you're either born with it or you're not, and I think it runs in families. I mean, I have cousins and uncles that are in the arts. Your dad, obviously, very connected to
the arts.
The arts.
Yeah.
And I obviously, you need to live in an environment which supports it,
mm-hmm.
but there are plenty of families that have a Zeppo.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, poor Zeppo. Zeppo Marx. If you've never seen any of the Marx Brothers movies, there is a fourth Marx Brother, but you wouldn't know it.
You wouldn't know it.
Because it was just the youngest kid. They shoved him out on stage because they were all out on stage, and
everyone needs to earn a paycheck, kid.
Never knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Never. Just talking to Groucho like he's talking
I'm
to a fence.
I'm setting up this next joke for you.
Why, Groucho, you're incorrigible. God love him, he's swinging for the fences.
He's trying.
And he's hitting himself in the shin.
You're doing it wrong, Zeppo.
Yeah,
you're
so
doing it wrong.
It's not just environment, because obviously Zeppo grew up in the same house that Harpo grew
yeah,
up in.
Yeah, like, that's a very good point.
All the Wayans brothers were in the same house. That's all I'll say.
I mean,
the Belushis.
Okay, we're getting the Farleys. Let's not go.
Chris
keep going.
Farley's brother is opening for like Norm now.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh God. All right. Well, check out I Am Chris Farley, the documentary. It comes out in a few months.
I did see some clips on that.
Yeah. What else, man?
The greatest thing in the world.
This week.
It's currently Dark Tower, Stephen King.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've read all 7 books within about, I think, 8 months.
Is he done with those? Or is
yeah,
he gonna do
I'm on the final book.
And it's the final
book. It's the Dark Tower.
Okay, so there will be no 8th Dark Tower.
No. There is. I mean, unless he's crazy, but I mean, I haven't gotten to the end of it, but people are dying left and right, so I don't think so. But, so I'm completely, I'm writing this album right now, mm-hmm. and it's called Leaping with Intent to Fly, mm-hmm. and it's just pretty much like, kind of like, I don't want to say a journal, but kind of very much like, I'm a struggling artist, this is going to be the first, like, this is something I see, like, I don't even know what I'm looking for necessarily, but I'm walking towards it, you know, and I see it, and I get it. Just the same way as the character in the book is going for his dark tower, you know what I mean? And all these ups and downs, and I just feel very connected in that sense of, like, we're on this journey. Like, I'm reading about some dude's journey, I'm writing about a journey, and so I'm very connected with that kind of ideal right now.
That's
so
cool.
The Dark Tower.
Yeah, I actually just discovered the original Fleetwood Mac. Not Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks and Chrissy McVie, but the band they were before then. Because I've been getting into Peter Green lately. And Peter Green is like, he's one of these guys, he's like the backstage crew of rock and roll. Like, everybody in music knows how important he is, but people don't know who he was.
Right.
And he took over the lead guitar spot in the Blues Breakers after Eric Clapton did the Beano album. And one of the interesting things about him was when he got the job for the Blues Breakers, Clapton had just made history by playing a Les Paul through a Marshall for the first time on the Beano album. And then everybody had to do that. And then Clapton quit to start Cream, where he would just do that with Marshall
right.
stacks. So when Peter Green got the job, he said, well, I need to buy a Les Paul and a Marshall because that's the sound of this band. So he bought the only Les Paul that was, because they'd been out of production for, you know, 7 years, and the neck pickup didn't work. So he took it back in, and when they fixed it, they screwed up and they accidentally flipped the neck pickup. They flipped the magnet. So when you turned both pickups on, it was out of phase. And it was the first out of phase sound anyone heard. So he was very in LSD, and he just played it all the time. And there's a song called Supernatural on the one Blues Breakers album he did, which is called The Hard Road. And you can hear the guitar feedback and rattle the window of the control room. It's so full and loud. And the notes just ring on forever. It's incredible. And then, so I was reading about him, and he created, after he left the Blues Breakers, he stole the bass player, who was John McVie, and got Mick Fleetwood, and they started Fleetwood Mac, and they were a straight up blues band for like 3 years. And they did songs like Oh Well and Albatross that are just incredible guitar songs. And then he, like, lost his mind on LSD, had, like, a psychotic break, and retired. And then they left Mick Fleetwood and John McVie, and they were like, we got to build this band again. They got two girl singers, and then all of a sudden they're playing Go Your Own Way.
Yeah,
it's
completely different.
I don't know why they didn't change the name of the band, because it's completely not that band. But I've been very...
It was catchy.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? Fleetwood Mac is named after Mick Fleetwood and John McVie.
Yeah, well,
so
there you go.
There was no Green in there.
Yeah. No, actually, it was Fleetwood Mac Green.
Yeah,
and they were like, "This is easy. This is easy enough to drop."
But I've been like super into Les Pauls lately, cool. So I've been trying to find like guys that played Les Pauls that I haven't listened to.
Well, you have one.
I have two now.
I was gonna say, I think you have two.
We'll show you.
Yeah, please, and So that's like your music thing right now?
Yeah.
Like book-wise or whatever?
I listen. Yeah, that's where I am right now. And I had a 14-hour drive. I listened to a lot of it on the way in, a lot of Yardbirds too while I was at it. And then on the way back, I'll be doing the same thing.
Cool.
But Billy, how can we find you online?
BillyConahan.com has all my links to everything else. You could search, you can Google Billy Conahan, and I believe I'm like the first 10 pages. So anything you want, all my music is currently free on BillyConahan.bandcamp.com. Check out my YouTube page, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that good stuff. And yeah, literally, the name is everything.
And so. The CD, the album is currently CD is like saying a record now. So your album will be first.
I have 6 mixtapes online. So they're all just free downloads, you know, just random material. Like 3 full mixtapes and then 3 EPs on the side. And then this album that I'm currently writing, producing, and recording is going to be the first, like, hard copy, like, sold kind of stuff. I'm going to be selling the CD.
The CD will be sold in stores.
Yes, strictly in stores. So yeah, so that's like the move right now.
That's cool. Well, you can follow me and Out of My Book on Twitter, and that is the official Twitter handle of the podcast. You can like us on Facebook, and you can listen to us on Stitcher, and you can listen to us on iTunes, and you can, I believe we're on Podbean, but I never got a confirmation. And you can go right to our main page, the Caffeinated Comics Blogspot page, and listen to us there. You can visit Steven at the store when he is on the show at Chimera's Comics, which is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. And I will talk to you when I get back to the city.
Peace.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!